Hello, and welcome to Conversations with Dr. Stephen Greer. And this is Dr. Greer, and I'm joined today by Dr. Ted Loader, who's the science advisor for the Disclosure Project and also the OrionProject.org. And I'd like to thank the folks at the World Pooja Network for allowing us this hour every 2 weeks to share with their listeners information and updates of what are happening with our projects. And welcome to the show, Dr. Loader.
Thank you very much, Steve. This is going to be a very interesting show.
It is. And as a way of introduction, I just want to introduce DisclosureProject.org. Everybody can go to that site and see what we've been doing over the last decade or two in terms of getting out all the really super secret information related to UFOs, extraterrestrial intelligence, and advanced energy and propulsion systems. And as most listeners may know by now, in May of 2001, we had a press conference at the National Press Club where 22 of these military and intelligence and corporate witnesses to UFO projects or events were present. And what a lot of people who have seen that National Press Club event don't realize is that those were 22 out of the sum at this point over 550 top secret military and corporate whistleblowers and intelligence and military and corporate people that I have met with and interviewed and gathered information from. And what we're going to be talking about today is the testimony of a very important witness, William John Pawelek, is how you say his last name, although it's spelled P-A-W-E-L-E-C. And this is a gentleman who I had met some years ago and interviewed actually exactly 10 years ago this month in December of 2000. And he, at the time, did not want his information out to the public for fear of reprisals, and he knew of people who had been killed talking about some of the things that are in this interview, and he asked that I only release it after his death. Recently, his significant other, widow, contacted us and said that, in fact, Mr. Pawelek had passed away and that she discovered in his notes that he wanted the testimony he'd provided to the Disclosure Project to be released. And it turns out this gentleman passed away about 3 years ago, but she had just gotten around to contacting us. He passed away, according to the death certificate, in on May 24th, 2007. Now, what's important about this testimony, and I have to say this is emblematic of so many dozens and dozens of men and a few women that I've interviewed who have been in very sensitive meetings, is that they do fear for their lives and their families, and so they do not want to do this while they're living, or they provide information to me but do not want to be out publicly like the, oh, some 70 witnesses that are in the Disclosure Project book. If you go to disclosureproject.org, you'll see that there's a nearly 600-page book that has about 69 of these military and top-secret witnesses' testimony in them. And also we have a four-hour DVD and a two-hour DVD, as well as the National Press Club DVD itself at disclosureproject.org that you can get and look at. But I always emphasize to people that's the tip of an iceberg, a huge iceberg of information, intelligence, sources, names of corporations, agencies, et cetera, that we have. And that a lot of the times the assessments that I'm providing to people, always the assessments that I'm providing to people, whether it's in a meeting with a member of Congress or a member of senior member of the Pentagon, or to the public on a show like this, is informed by all of that gathering of information and intelligence from hundreds and hundreds of people, like this a very brave Mr. Pawlik, who I think took an enormous amount of courage for even sit and tell what he knew on camera, and of course a great deal of trust, because he trusted me not to release this information while he was still living, and in fact I did not do so. Being a medical doctor, I know how to keep a confidence, and so I have many confidences that I have kept like this. Now, what's important about this as well is that we have a signed statement from him and permission to release this upon his death, and the letter now from his next of kin, his significant other, as well as a copy of the birth certificate. So now that this has all been established, we will release to the public this testimony in toto, in its entirety. And in fact, at CSETI.org, CSETI.org, and DisclosureProject.org, you will be able to go there, and there will be a link to the entire unedited interview with this gentleman, so that you can hear it. But I want to discuss it on this show today on the World Pooja Network, and as a way of background, introduce the idea that what we're going to be talking about with this particular interview not only establishes the reality of extraterrestrial vehicles visiting the planet, but also from the sightings and things he knew, but also of an intelligence operation that is beyond black, that has manipulated the subject and taken over control of the subject away from the conventional political sphere, and some of the things and the repercussions of that. And so we're going to have a lot to cover in this hour, but when you look at this full interview, you'll get a sense of it. Now, a lot of what I want to do in the course of this interview is to provide the perspective and connect the dots, because once again, this is, it's like a mosaic. This gentleman knew what he was involved with and saw the things he saw. On the other hand, I have hundreds of people like him who don't know each other, who corroborate components of it or fill in and connect the dots. And this is exactly what I, you know, basically what I try to bring to this is that perspective. Having interviewed and sat with for thousands of hours, hundreds of these types of people who've worked in the intelligence community and in corporations and the military, dealing directly with the UFOs, extraterrestrial intelligence, and the technologies that are associated with them. So that's really what we want to cover today. It's a very exciting program, and so I think we'll, with that introduction, we'll get right on into it. And Dr. Lode, I'd like to, you, for you to just share some of the things that, that when you looked at this interview of Mr. Pawlik, how, what you took away from it and what impressed you with it.
Well, I think the first of all, I thoroughly enjoyed it. In watching him discuss and describe his experiences and the things he saw and learned about, the man is very solid. It is no woo-woo at all. This is I was impressed. I was very impressed. I mean, he's as somebody noted, he's like your family doctor who really knows his stuff. He just totally solid in his descriptions. A little bit of his back. There's so many things that we're going to be going through in this hour, and so many dots to connect. I'll just start off here by giving a little bit of a background to him, which is probably a good way to start. It's the way he starts in the interview. He was in the Air Force. He's a computer specialist. He spent time at the Air Force base in the South East, and then was off in Vietnam for a year dealing with processing intelligence data. And it was obvious he had some interesting opinions on the Vietnam War, which I'm not going to go into right now. But he ultimately left the Air Force, even though they wanted him to continue because of his experience, computer experience. He went off to college and did his college thing in that area. And finally, he decided to get into electronics and got his security clearances back. And he started working in the area of access control. Now, access control is... it deals with security and is absolutely crucial and critical to all the things that deal with the Disclosure Project, in a sense, because without access and control mechanisms in place, it's impossible to keep things really secret. and with black projects and what have you. He got into that area and as a result was able and went into underground facilities and dealt with other issues that we'll get into. So that's how he got into it and ultimately worked for large companies and then worked for his own private companies, doing some work with Federal Express and other people, setting up major computer programs dealing with this security issues. He worked with SAIC, Tracor, and others. But he did, as it went along, he realized that something, as he stated, something was amiss. Things weren't all they seemed to be. And then he got involved in the Tonopah base in Nevada, which he described huge elevators very deep underground. They were doing security work there. And it's interesting because the question is, did you see any UFOs, if you will, or craft there? And he said, no, but everything was moved out of the rooms as we went in to do the security work. So our men went down there. Everything was cleared out. You could see where they had moved things away from. They did the security work, and he figured things were put back in those rooms. So it sort of did a shell game with the materials, so they couldn't actually see what was going on. But the elevators in those underground bases were so huge they could hold huge aircraft going up and down many, many stories underground. And this particular base, and Steve, maybe you could talk about it a bit more. Very remote.
It's spelled T-O-N-O-P-A-H, and it's in southern Nevada. It is a facility where there's a lot of EG&G operations there, and it's a underground facility that is connected to other underground facilities that went operational back in the 70s and 80s. One of the things, going back before that, however, when he was in the Air Force at Pope Air Force Base in North Carolina, where I grew up, in 1966, he was there near the base with a friend, and it was in the evening, and about a 35 to 40 foot diameter disc, he says, whiter than any white he's ever seen before. Mm-hmm. Floated overhead about 50 feet up and about 200 or 300 feet away at the edge of a lake. And as it approached, all the insects and frogs and everything in the region that you could hear for miles around became utterly silent. And as it moved along, the silence went along with it. And he said that it was at that point that he realized, of course, that we weren't alone. And it's interesting because his description of this craft, the kind of light and the kind of white that he see is exactly what we've seen on some of our expeditions, where it's a white like you've never seen, a light like you've never seen. And he said that the craft was, you could tell there's a structure above it, but it was a sort of disc-shaped on the bottom, and it was utterly silent, and it created this zone of silence, and somehow the electromagnetic field effect that it created as it moved along was sensed by all the insects and animals, so that it, just this utter silence attended its floating over the countryside there outside of Pope Air Force Base in North Carolina. So that was one very graphic sort of description that he provides. And late in the interview, he goes back to it because I asked more about it. How remarkable it is, how the effect of this vehicle. And he said, you know, basically that it was talked about in the circles where he worked, that these were ABCs or alien
yes.
visitation craft, and no one called them UFOs. And, of course, I've said for years that UFOs are just a term that was invented by the intelligence community after they knew that they were extraterrestrial vehicles. And, of course, there are two categories of UFOs. One are the man-made ones, and he talks about the research and people he'd met in aerospace circles going back to the 50s, early 50s and 60s, where that by the 60s and 70s they had fully figured out all the mechanisms of function of these craft. And these are, of course, have been called in some circles ARVs, alien reproduction vehicles. But the ones that are of off-planet origin are called alien visitation craft, or in some other circles, ETVs, extraterrestrial vehicles. So it's interesting that in the business, they're not called UFOs. And so this is only in the pop culture world where the mind got colonized by the intelligence community to set up UFO organizations so that we could say they're unidentified and they fly, but gee, we don't know what they are. When in reality, back in the 40s and 50s, we knew that they were extraterrestrial vehicles, and then later we had the ones that we were building that were the electromagnetic gravitic craft, the anti-gravity type craft that we call alien reproduction vehicles. And that, you know, here's a man, and you'll see this in the interview, with a twinkle in his eye, and he said, just matter-of-factly, this is what they were called, or AVCs, alien reproduction craft. And so this is exactly what I've been immersed in for now 20 years of meetings. I mean, I remind people that it was 17 years ago this month that I briefed the director of Central Intelligence, the CIA director, on this matter for President Clinton. And what I have found is that there's this enormous disconnect between the pop culture take on this subject and what's really going on. And a lot of that is because that's been orchestrated by the controllers, the intelligence community, who what this man eventually calls the four horsemen, the four groups that exist around the world that are competing for control over this and other subjects, and sometimes they cooperate together, and sometimes they oppose each other. And of course, I've spoken many times on this show that the classified super black world that deals with this transcends national boundaries and politics as we know it. And he came to realize that very quickly. In the Vietnam War, he states in this interview that he and the other people he was dealing with he saw firsthand that it was a political war, and he didn't say this, but I know this to be true, to basically create a conflict to focus people on and to spend money for the war profiteers, and that there was no intention of winning that war. There was no intention ever of it being a war of necessity or a war of to be won, quote unquote, and that there is the cynical underpinning of a lot of these quote unquote national security and military operations that have absolutely nothing to do with the national security of the United States or the security and peace of the world.
Mm-hmm. Like to add absolutely correct. I'd like to add a comment about his. Back to the AVCs, he stated what both you and I have spoken about, and I've written about it, so have you. All the major aerospace industries were involved in the development of anti-gravity craft.
Correct.
He stated research early in the 50s and 60s, by early 70s, as you noted, we had the problems solved.
Right.
And this is what we've seen from multiple other witnesses in the disclosure project. So it was just another confirmation dot on what we've been saying, and I wrote about in the paper that I published a number of years ago about this topic that's on the disclosure project website. So it was.
Is that the out of the box?
That's the out of the box paper on terrestrial transportation or transportation technology of the 21st century. So it was really nice to see him confirm or agree with, so to speak, what we've observed and talked to people for years.
Well, he did, and he also confirmed, of course, that in terms of, for example, he was talking about how EGNG, which is a company I've mentioned, he said basically controls Southern Nevada, which had been involved in the development of the atomic bomb. And that there are black within black within black projects. And basically, there's no auditing and control on this, and there's a blank check. And that he observed that, for example, the F-117 fighters were at Tonopah up to a certain point, and then very quickly they spent $85 million to relocate them to Holloman to make room for something else, and that is this secret space force that are alien reproduction vehicles and what have you. I know this from other witnesses. Mm-hmm. And that the Tonopah facility is in an area much more private than so-called Area 51, and that he had helped design boulders that could be positioned on hills around that facility that could pick up something as small as a jackrabbit and image it and sense it as it moved across the desert for security.
Up to 10 kilometers away.
Control.
Up to 10 kilometers away, which is really high-end technology.
Yes, and this was back, of course, in the 70s and 80s.
Yep.
Yeah, 10 kilometers away. Imagine what they have today, you know, 30 years later. And so that, of course, Space Command would secure the airspace above that area. But the even ground control for intruder alerts, that he had worked on these systems, and that this is a, he said, obviously the kind of resources being put into these fiber optic and microwave and systems back then were for a very long-term project. It wasn't for a short-term project because it was a huge investment. He did talk about that in a very detailed way. And, he mentioned also that there's sort of an alternative government control that beginning in 1979, in North Glen, Colorado, that he was involved with a man who developed a type of tracking chip that could be put in horses so that if somebody had two similar horses and one wasn't as good as the other, they couldn't slip in one horse or the other for people to bet on. And what he called shilling the horses. And that this implant could be put under the skin with a large hypodermic, and it worked very well. And this was, of course, now 31 years ago. And he ended up taking this to a SCIF, a Secure Communication Intelligence Facility, with a man that he knew who had been at the beginning of the CIA and from its inception. And with a man who also had been at the State Department, because he thought this could be used to help retrieve people, because at that time there were a lot of kidnappings of officials, and even the Prime Minister of Italy had been kidnapped so that they could be retrieved and found, sort of like people do now for their pets and whatnot. And so, you know, he had had this whole concept of, you know, doing this, and he went there for this meeting, and he said, here are these two guys, one allegedly from the Department of Agriculture and one from the Treasury, who had all access passes, who had not been invited to the meeting, and who just happened to be there. Now, this has happened to me many times, by the way, and these are people who just show up, and they have an all access pass, and he says literally their access into access control, they would, the biometrics, the whatever it would be, would pass. And yet when you look up and see who those people are, no such person really exists. So these are these kind of shadowy figures, not a myth, and this goes on all the time. And they were representing this alternative government, secret government control, who actually ended up taking this chip. The man who invented it, apparently, he said, got very wealthy and never had to work again for the rest of his life. But they wanted to make 2 billion of them. Now, remember, this is in 1979. And that they had transponder capabilities, they could monitor blood pressure, pulse, even brainwave activity from a distance, and that this was something that he was very amused by, because then in 1999 he saw on the internet some woman who had quote missing time, like you have with these people who report alien abductions. We're going to get to this in a minute. And there was a blow-up of this implant, and it was absolutely just a modified version of what he had brought to the CIA in 1979, 20 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if people aren't connecting the dots now, drink a cup of coffee and wake up. Wake up! Wake up, wake up, wake up. For about 18 years, I've been telling people that a lot of what passes as quote-unquote alien is what we call stagecraft, and this is exactly what is called in some of the top-secret documents I have, to simulate a threat from outer space, which is false, and up to and including the implantation of chips and other types of things. And then later he ended up, in pursuing the electronics he did, he ended up meeting a man from who is a professor at University of New South Wales in Australia, and this man had developed an even more sophisticated chip, and he also went and met with this person at the State Department for their security, thinking this would be a good thing for some very legitimate purposes, and a couple of other spooks were there that were all access folks, and You know, they may have had a national security agency or a national reconnaissance office badge or whatever, but they were really not assigned to that. And that basically, here too, they were asking questions. And this particular chip back then,
it was in 1984, I believe.
This is in 1984, ironically. Would be able to be read easily from space, 120 kilometers above the Earth. And that even further than that, if they put a power boost source inside the chip. So that, you know, here we're talking now almost 30 years ago. We're at almost 2011. And that this man, this professor, got an enormous grant, then was so wealthy he never had to work again for the rest of his life. We've heard this story many times. And that this friend of his, who had been with the CIA, and the head of security for Foggy Bottom, for the State Department, had this meeting. But again, there were two people who came who really took control of it. And it turns out that they were making billions of these out of a division of Siemens Corporation.
The big European company.
Big European electronic firm in Silicon Valley. And after they had a few billion of these made, they shut down that plant.
Yep, it's interesting enough. The reason he got into that or found out about that was, again, he was involved in the security for the place,
correct,
the building. And so they installed this top-of-the-line security system for the place. And about a year later, the company called him up and says, hey, you can take it back. We're done. They folded up their company and left.
Billions. Right.
He estimated billions.
One of the tragedies of this, his friend, who he said was Bob, and we're not going to go further than that because we don't have permission from that family. I've seen other documents. I'll just leave it at that, that this man has had while he was living. But his friend Bob, who had been head of security for the State Department, wanted to give his high school age boys an experience of living overseas. So he kind of demoted himself and moved to Nairobi, Kenya, and did security there for State Department. And it was then that, you know, both this guy Bob and this gentleman, Paulik, who we're talking about, whose interview is up on our website now, were really wanting to pursue what is this alternative government, who are doing this, because obviously they were doing this transnationally, they were doing it with unlimited funds, they were doing it with agendas that were not normal, quote-unquote, black security. Even the black projects, this is beyond that. It's like when I was meeting with the head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he said, look, I've been involved in lots of black projects, things that officially don't exist. Nothing like this has ever been anything under my control. This is a parallel universe, but it exists. And so this man, Bob, it turns out, had found or traced down something into this super secret organization that's transnational. And his Paulik's friend at the CIA called him and said, look, we're going to get another meeting with Bob. He has some real news to share with us about who these people are who've been taking these chips and what they're doing with them. And it was then that his friend Bob tragically was killed outside Nairobi in an alleged accident when a reinforced Land Rover hit him at an intersection at 60 miles an hour and killed him instantly. There was a British commando-style guy driving that vehicle who was nominally injured and left the hospital, and it turned out that all of his ID was fake and that the person whose name it was in that accident never existed.
Yep.
So, you know, this is also a pattern that I've seen over and over again where these kinds of things are done, and which is why there's a strategy to how I've done disclosure, and that is to involve you, those of you listening, millions and millions of people. Eventually, the Disclosure Project event has been seen by something like a billion people around the world, and it has to be, because if there's only three or four people who know about something like this, and they start to move, they're in what we call the box, the shooting box. And they're taken out, and his friend Bob, who had been this wonderful guy who had discovered this, was taken out. And tragically, and of course, everyone who has been close to something like this happening. And he mentioned something that is very poignant for me, and that is that a lot of times this will be done in a way that is a plausibly accidental situation or even a disease. If listeners of the show will recall, back in the 1990s, a friend of former CIA Director Bill Colby, who had been a member of one of these super secret projects dealing with all this information, was going to get to me an operational free energy device and around $50 million in seed funding from some source that he had, because he really believed in what we were trying to do and the purpose behind it, which were peaceful purpose of fixing a lot of problems in the world in a very altruistic way, frankly. And so Bill Colby, getting up there in age, was determined to do something about it and not just take all this to his grave. And the week that he was going to meet with a member of my board of directors, they found former CIA Director Bill Colby floating down the Potomac River, allegedly drowned in a canoeing accident. Now, it's interesting because his friend, who is a colonel, a full bird colonel, told us that, in fact, he was assassinated. He told us, in fact, that even his wife knew that, and the wife went on CNN and said, look, you know, it wasn't like Bill Colby to go out canoeing at night in a rain-swollen, flooded Potomac River, leaving the house open, the coffee maker on, and his computer on. But that's how it all happened. Now, this has never been written off as anything but an accidental drowning, but we know it was an assassination, and it was a shot across the bow, basically saying to other people inside these secret groups, don't hand off this level of technology and information to Dr. Greer, and if you do, here's what's going to happen. And I think that this has been a pattern which for me personally has been very, very difficult to cope with, and you can only imagine, because it was around that time that both myself and my assistant and long-term friend Sherry Adamack, as well as Congressman Schiff, developed very aggressive metastatic cancers. And they died, and I survived, and, you know, you get a little survivor's guilt with something like that. And this man, Powlett, brings up this mysterious cancer that became so aggressive, and it was a type of skin cancer that's normally not that aggressive, and that there was something very suspicious about it, because it appeared when Congressman Schiff was pushing for the cover-up about the Roswell events and all these secret projects to end and to get this information disclosed. And, of course, we were involved with that. So he mentions this very specifically in this interview, not in a long way, but he makes a remark about it, which I think is very interesting.
Another one of those dots, tying things together.
Another dot to connect. And, of course, from my own personal life, I can absolutely confirm that. Kind of behavior, what I call this sort of the largest global organized crime syndicate that exists. Yeah.
One of the other things he mentioned that I thought was very interesting, and I've heard so many times before, and he starts off with talking about the issue of secrecy. And the question, of course, is so often, or the statement is made by so many people who don't really understand things, oh, our government can't keep a secret. It's getting harder with WikiLeaks going on these days, but anyway, that's another topic.
Well, I'll talk about that in a moment.
Good. But nevertheless, secrecy in our government has been going on for many years. And actually, if the people in the project, as he noted, if people within the project truly believe in their project and what have you, actually the project can be kept secret. And there's a long history of projects that are just coming to light today that were going on during World War II. In 40, 50 years, before the people and the public actually became aware of some of these projects. So it is possible for the government to keep projects totally secret, either totally secret or secret by diversion, which is sort of another technique that's used today.
Well, and he was talking about the endless money involved, that, and this was in the Washington Post and Newsweek back some years ago, when the National Reconnaissance Office was building an $800 million headquarters, almost as large as the CIA headquarters, there outside Washington. And no monies had ever been appropriated by any committee of the Congress to build it. Where did this $800 million come from?
And nobody at that time knew who was building the building.
and no one knew who was building the building.
Okay.
And it was a National Reconnaissance Office building. And this is all in the public record now. You can go look it up. So this is the kind of things we're talking about. So when I tell people that, you know, there are, and of course even Rumsfeld said sometime right around 9/11 that there's $2 or 3 trillion missing out of the Department of Defense budget over the last few decades. This is the stuff it's been going into. And it's, of course, our money. But more importantly, it's our information and intelligence. But it's been going into something that is a transnational, I don't even say international, because that connotes sort of national, conventional, political cooperation and control, which this entity is not. It's a transnational group of folks. And he says in this interview, it's all about power and control. Mm-hmm. It isn't about the money per se, because they basically, he saw people just go to the Treasury and say, cut a check, and Treasury cuts a check. They have people inside the Treasury. They have people inside the banking and financial world. So this transfer, and he says it's literally their money is no object. And I have been told this by people back in the early and mid-90s when I was personally offered a $2 billion fund, billion. If I would basically stop doing what I was doing and capitulate and basically shut down what I was doing and merge it with an operation that these intelligence folks were running. And I said, no, thank you. I'm not going to do that. And there's been a lot of pressure over the years in all forms for us to do that. And we've never capitulated. And we've always stayed above that fray and fiercely independent, which, of course, angers a lot of people. But too bad. You know, it's like that level of integrity, not for sale. NFS, you know, it's not for sale. So, and this man had seen these sort of things happening up close and personal with his clearances and security work, which I think is a very interesting corroboration.
Mm-hmm. He was very concerned. And in a question that you asked him, where is this all headed? He expressed his concerns for freedom of the country and the world.
Yes, of course.
In terms of losing control of ourselves. And he also felt that the Fourth Estate, the media, of course, is totally manipulated, and that it really is not doing its job at all.
Oh, yeah, the media is a completely wholly owned subsidiary of this kind of stuff, even though most of the reporters don't know it, unless they step into this field, and then they find out real quick that they can't. It's like this guy who was the head of ABC News 2020 and whatnot, and you know, we gave him 35 digital hours of these kind of top secret folks' testimony, and he called me up a couple weeks after the Disclosure Project, and you know, I said, look, why can't you get the show on? You said you were in charge of these shows, and he says, well, you know, they won't let me. And I said, who are they? And he said, well, Dr. Greer, you know who they are. And this was the guy who, you know, had been right hand to Mike Wallace at 60 Minutes and moved over to be over at ABC in charge, executive producer of Primetime Live in 2020. He's back now at 60 Minutes. But, you know, they're never allowed to do these stories. Now, and the other interesting thing that I want listeners to listen to carefully is that he said, you know, people hear of black projects, but these are black within black. And I've said for years how this works. For example, we have a witness, Donna Hare, who had worked for a while with Science Applications International Corporation, SAIC, which is one of the crown jewels of the secret government contracting world, along with the big aerospace, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and EG&G, and E-Systems, Raytheon E-Systems, and some others.
BAE.
But this person said, you know, Donna Hare said, look, you know, I was in an office, and it involved huge contracts, and basically they were empty file folders, and we would generate a phony report. It would be sent to Congress. The money, and that those were black projects and super secret, but there's really nothing going on in those. The money would then pass through that door into the super secret stuff dealing with this issue and into mm-hmm. this sort of transnational secret government entity. And, you know, Senator Inouye of Hawaii said during the Iran-Contra trial that there exists a secret government with its own Air Force, its own Navy, its own funding mechanism that is above the law and free from the law itself. I'm quoting very closely, but you can look at that quote that's on disclosureproject.org, and this and more information in the book Disclosure, which I recommend anyone listening should get that book and read it and probably memorize it because there's so much information in it. The other thing he shared germane to that, not SAIC, but in this case, Northrop Grumman, my uncle, who, of course, was the senior project engineer that designed the lunar module, that put the first man on the moon. The lunar module was the thingy that landed with Neil Armstrong in it, for those of you who may not recall or too young to remember.
Too young.
Yeah, since it was 40-some years ago. But what's interesting about this is that he said Northrop Grumman had someone he knew who worked in there, and then he was working with in security, that had a multi-billion-dollar project that went through one black project into this world, and it involved the Northrop Plant 29. I will just give you that data, Northrop Plant 29.
Mm-hmm.
He let that slip. You have to listen very carefully to the interview to pick up that, but my ears perked up because I've heard of that before.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an explosive interview. It's a very explosive information. Some people will find it disturbing. I always point out something that my friend Apollo astronaut Brian O'Leary would say when he'd say, you know, the truth will set you free, but first it'll piss you off. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, at a certain point, I tell people it's childhood, and people need to really understand these issues, and that the freedom of the world, the destiny of our species, the state of the environment are not in the hands of the folks that we elect and put in the White House or in Congress, but we need to ask that they get their hands back around this. But it takes enormous courage to, because you're going up against an entity that has such enormous power that most people, it's like a good friend of President Clinton said to me, you know, after I briefed the CIA director, said, look, you know, they're very supportive of what you're recommending, but they're convinced that the president will end up like Jack Kennedy if he does what you're suggesting.
Mm-hmm.
And to which I began laughing, thinking the man was joking, because this was back in, you know, the early 90s. I didn't believe that. And he stopped me. He says, no, we are not joking. And this man actually points out the fact that the Secretary of Commerce, I think it was Brown,
yes,
during the Clinton years, who died in this alleged aircraft crash, that the woman who was one of his aides was on the plane and was just bruised. But by the time they got her down off the mountain, she had been killed by some British commandos who work for this secret government entity, and that sources he had at Dover Air Force Base had seen that Brown actually had what looked like damage from a bullet to the brain, but that it was probably one of these what are called nitrogen or CO2 bullets that are a frozen material that then thaws, and there's no actual physical bullet, and there are guns that shoot what are called CO2 or frozen nitrogen bullets, and that he said that the fact that this was inspected at all, his body before it was cremated, that there were people at Dover Air Force Base that got into a lot of trouble for that.
Just trying to do their job.
Just doing the job, what would normally be something you would do, but it was not allowed to be done.
Mm.
So, you know, he says these kinds of things happen, and that it's a way for this group to establish and put down a marker, just like I believe they did with the CIA director, Bill Colby, who was breaking free of this, I think, very power-hungry and misguided group of folks. And they, you know, made an example of him. And there are a lot of us that have had these kind of things happen in various ways. But at the same time, we know that there are now a growing number of people in this secret government apparatus who support what we've been trying to do. I think if it were not the case, I would not be alive talking to you on this show. But and I don't mean to be melodramatic. I'm just telling you the facts. So I don't need to be melodramatic. In fact, if anything I tell you, it's about tenfold understated, even though it may seem extraordinary to most people hearing this for the first time. So that is exactly how this works. And unfortunately, for us, it means that usually political leaders and the wealthy and the powerful, conventional powerful people, don't want to step into this. And this is why the people need to know about it, and the people need to come together and do something about it, whether it's bringing out the free energy devices that pull energy out of the space around us, making peaceful contact with extraterrestrial intelligence, or disclosing all this kind of information, and that's why we need your help. I mean, this is something that has got to have the public involved. And to find out more about what you can do, you can go to disclosureproject.org or CSETI, CSETI.org, and also the Orionproject.org.
Right, and so true. I think anybody listening to this is going to find this very, very interesting. One of the other dots that he mentions along the way, which is a theme that we've seen within the Disclosure Project witnesses, is the use of or the involvement of, quote, foreigners within the secret programs.
Right.
He mentions that many times when he was in some of these areas that he worked in, there would be foreigners present who seemed to have all the qualifications or all the access passes to work there. This goes along with the concept of an international or beyond international organization running these things. It reminds me of the Disclosure Project witness who had seen pictures of structures on the moon, talking about many foreign people within the hangar in Langley.
Right, and yes, yeah. And it was a national security agency operation, and
right.
There were people from all over the world working there. Now, what people don't know is that if you are not a U.S. citizen, you cannot normally go into a classified Department of Defense facility, because we have a very senior scientist at one of the Department of Defense labs, the largest Department of Defense lab, who is a very close associate and friend of ours. And you know, when we at times have wanted to go there for a meeting to evaluate some technology or what have you, if the person has not been an American, he can't get in. And yet, in this parallel universe, the places are swarming with people from the various countries. So what's mm-hmm. going on here? And I think that, you know, he makes the point that basically the work that EG&G and a lot of the Lockheed Martin and Aerospace Company is offline, black within black within black, and that he thinks that, you know, at this point, and by the year 2000, even the Skunk Works were just a cover story for another black thing deeper and further black than the Skunk Works that Lockheed has, the Lockheed mm-hmm. Skunk Works, dealing with these issues. And this doesn't surprise me, because I know a few years ago I had a meeting in San Francisco, sort of a salon, for lack of a better word, where, you know, a very wealthy person hosts me at a home, and they invite, you know, 20 or 30 of the most, you know, connected, famous people in the area. And I was there sort of as the mystery guest that no one knew who I was and why I would be there. And so after some dinner and everything got quiet, and I started sharing about this information. Well, it turns out one of the people who was there had been the chairman of AT&T, but also had been chairman of what's called SRI, Stanford Research International. And he told me quite sincerely that he knew that there were black within black projects carried into SRI through DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Administration work. However, he wasn't privy to them. He was chairman. I mean, he was the head of it, but that it was outside of his ability to know what they were doing. So, you know, the way this is structured, my friends, is not your typical, you know, top-down corporate or the president and the chain of command, the secretary of defense and the CIA director. This is a parallel universe, and this is what we keep getting from these deep insiders over and over and over again. You know, if I heard it from one person, I'd get, conspiracy theory. But when you hear it from dozens of them, who don't know each other, by the way, who tell you the same information about the same places and corporations and facilities, et cetera, and so on. I mean, he mentions EG&G, for example, as owning the private airline that flies the people into Area 51 and into Pahoot Mesa and the Papoose facility and all these sort of facilities and Tonopah. And, you know, you keep seeing this and hearing this, and at a certain point, you know that it's legitimate, because there are people who absolutely do not know each other and never met each other that are connected through the Disclosure Project who have these corroborating points of intelligence and information.
So that's a good summary of what's in it. I think we've given you a number of highlights from his hour-long interview, And I think, but once you sit down and actually watch this and listen to this man tell us what he's seen and observed and his thoughts about it, it's very revealing and a bit overwhelming, particularly if you've heard this show and heard us connect some of the dots for you. When you go hear it, you'll say, oh, my gosh, it's excellent.
Well, it is excellent. It's important for people to know this. And what I want to do is put it in a context here for a moment of action, because when I did this interview with him, and he did not want, of course, part of it, and I know the part of this that was most frightening for him, and it's not what you think, it's the fact that he knew that there were billions of these chips
mm-hmm.
that had been taken and have surreptitiously been put in people. Now, the reason for that, which means monitoring from space, control, he talked about scalar electromagnetics.
Mm-hmm.
There's a top secret scientist we're working with that we know very well who's actually done experiments with scalar communications that are faster than the speed of light. It's not limited by the velocity of light. We're not going to get into the physics of it, but this is not theoretical. This has been done. And this man of enormous, he's one of the 14 national treasures in the Department of Defense scientific community, and he's a very close friend of this project. And I can tell you that the kinds of technologies that exist like this that affect consciousness, control, what have you. And when I was at a meeting, it was I think 2 years ago this week, with a man who is in charge of weird science and frickin' magic, as it's called, WSFM at the CIA, who kind of runs that desk. Although every other time I meet him, he's like he's in a corporate setting. He's from DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, CIA. He's one of these people who moves around where you really don't know
what he does.
He's attached to. And I know he's attached to this group that we used to call Majestic, the Super Magi, MAJI clearance. What's interesting about it, in fact, is that I confronted him with the fact that they can remotely induce disease states and what have you, because I basically was saying this is what happened to my friend Sherry Adamack and Congressman Schiff and me and what, and he looked at me, didn't blink an eye, and we're sitting at a restaurant near Langley, CIA headquarters, and he says, yes, absolutely, we have all that. I mean, he didn't even attempt to deny it. So. You know, welcome to my world. Sometimes it's not, you know, it can be disturbing. But what's important for people to know is that this same system can be turned around and heal cancer. The same system in the right hands can be turned around and help regenerate a severed limb, can heal a spinal cord that where the neural connections have been severed. I'm not kidding. It has been done in secret projects, and I know the people who've done it. There is so much benefit, not only in terms of the environment, energy generation, but healing that can come out of this area of science. And unfortunately, the people who are hell-bent on just massive global control have it, and they're not afraid to weaponize it and use it against good people. But it doesn't mean that's the way it has to be. There has to be. People have to understand that if we, as the Bhagavad Gita says, knowledge is the greatest purifier. First you have to know, and then you can act. And so this is why disclosureproject.org is so important. People have to know the truth. Then they will have a framework in which to act. And it is that that has led to the Disclosure Project. And also the OrionProject.org being founded to try to identify clean funding sources so we can build a laboratory to build up peaceful uses of these systems under our watchful eye rather than some nefarious transnational secret organization's control. And a lot of people say, oh, it's too big, it's too difficult. Well, then you're just giving up. You cannot give up. This is the future of our species. This is the future of the Earth. And I'm not overstating the fact when I state this. So as we begin to 2011, we have to contemplate what the consequences of this are. And the consequences are immense. They cannot be overstated. And it's not likely that the political leaders are going to touch this that hot third rail. I guess I'm either crazy enough or brave enough or whatever enough to do it. And I've been doing it for 20 years. But the point is, it can't be done with one person or even a group of 10 people. It has to have a lot of people involved. And that's why DisclosureProject.org, if you go to that website, you're going to see the power of that, because it's hundreds and even thousands of pages of government documents. It's dozens of these types of courageous men, William John Palick's testimony that is now going to be up on the internet by the time you're listening to this interview. And this is the kind of thing that has to happen. I want to distinguish it from the WikiLeaks stuff for just a moment. WikiLeaks is putting stuff out there that is in the conventional mainline government control access system. And if it's legitimately classified and the president or secretary of state and Congress know it, we don't deal with that. Why? Because they're the elected and appointed people operating within the rule of law. The only things we put out there, and this is very different from WikiLeaks, are things that which we can prove are rogue, illegal, extra-constitutional, criminal operations. Let me repeat that. These are rogue, illegal, criminal operations. So you may disagree with whether or not everything that's in the classified State Department cables should have been or shouldn't have been classified, but that's not for me to say. I'm not the Secretary of State or the President or a member of the Senate Intelligence or Foreign Relations Committee. These projects that we're talking about are ones that lie to the President, lie to the Secretary of State, personally have lied to the CIA directors that I have known, and to the people who are the senior officers at the Pentagon. And I'm talking head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And my friends, if you are an entity, transnational, but in this country, taking huge hundreds of billions of dollars, trillions of taxpayer money, and you're lying to those folks, you are, by definition, rogue and illegal, and there is no security for you in terms of the conventional rule of law. That's very different from traditionally classified cables and stuff that have been ending up on WikiLeaks. I just want to make this very bright line distinction. One may be something where you disagree with the secrecy and you expose it, in which case you are probably breaking the law. In fact, they're going to get prosecuted. The things we're dealing with are operations which not even the president has control over and is lied to about, and therefore it is rogue and it is illegal, and therefore it is not at all like what's being released through WikiLeaks.
Yes, good summary of that issue. I'm glad you brought that up, because that's a big issue in the news these days.
It is a big issue in the news, and I wanted to make that distinction because people might have a tendency to conflate the two. And back in 1998, just to give people a little bit of history, after I had briefed members of the Senate Intelligence Committee and Foreign Relations Committee and the CIA director, and you name it. I mean, I'm the only person that you will ever hear interviewed who can state that he has done these things. And these were all people who had asked to be briefed because they suspected these things were going on, but were being denied access. Now, let me tell you, if you're the president of the United States or the CIA director or the head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, et cetera, and you are being denied access to projects that are going on inside an underground base in the United States, paid for by taxpayers, this is a problem, my friends. And so what we did in 1998 was to write a letter to all the agencies in the United States government and say, unless otherwise directed, we are declaring all these top secret witnesses, their documents, public domain, because the National Security Act does not apply to criminal illegal operations which are deceiving the Congress and the President. There was not a single response to me that contradicted our assessment in 1998. And that's why in 2000 and 2001, we collected all these people's testimony and documents and put them out there for the world to see. And guess what? Neither I nor any of these top secret witnesses have been prosecuted. And it's because we can prove, absolutely prove. And if this went to court, believe me, the CIA director I briefed, all these people would be subpoenaed. And they would have to state under oath what they said to me. And that is, they did not have access to this information. And this then proves that these operations are illegal. And if you're an illegal criminal enterprise, you can't cite the National Security Act to protect your hide. which is why anyone listening who knows a top secret witness to this stuff or a document or even a device, get it to us, because they have just been fooled thinking that it's under some kind of legitimate security. It is not. You can't break the law and break the Constitution and then claim the law is your shield. You can't have it both ways. And that's the point we made. And you know what? That's just the facts. Those are the legal facts. So the law is on our side. The Constitution is on our side. The truth is on our side. And I'll tell you something else, my friends. The future is on our side, because this stuff may play out in a lot of different ways, but ultimately we're going to make it through this, and people are going to know the truth about this, and we're going to go forward as a civilization in space peacefully with these amazing sciences and technologies. And a lot has to happen before that occurs, and it may not all be pretty and easy, but it will happen. And so we have to pray for that and work for that together, and that's why these projects exist. Well, I believe we're about out of time. I do want to thank Dr. Loader for joining us today, and I do want to thank, and we'll say a prayer for Bill Palick, who's in the worlds of light, and his family for finally releasing his testimony to us, and it's there now for all of the world to see. And again, when you see that testimony, just remember we have over 500 people like him that corroborate much of it, and that this is exactly the kind of information that the world needs to know so that they know how to go forward. We have to know where we are in order to go forward into the good future. So I'd like to thank the people at the World Pooja Network for hosting us, and all of you. And until next time, this is Conversations with Dr. Stephen Greer, and God bless you all.
Good night.